Welcome to this medical minute on non-opioid options for pain management. This activity is supported by an independent educational grant from the Opioid Analgesic REMS Program Companies, provided by Clinical Care Options, LLC, and in partnership with the American Academy of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, Practicing Clinicians Exchange, and ProCE. My name is Samantha Catanzano, and I am a pharmacist and board-certified psychiatric pharmacist, clinical assistant professor at the University of Texas at Austin College of Pharmacy, and practicing pharmacist at UT Health Austin. Today's objectives include identifying indications and mechanisms of action of non-opioid analgesics, as well as recognizing contraindications, adverse events, and drug-drug interactions associated with non-opioid medications. We'll also apply knowledge of non-opioid medications to make the most appropriate medication choice for patients. Like all chronic disease, chronic pain requires a multimodal approach. This can be depicted as trying to drive a car with four flat tires. Medications only fill up one tire, meaning that they play a partial role in relieving pain and improving function. An interdisciplinary team is essential in helping patients and caregivers identify needed components of their treatment plan. When considering medications for chronic pain, useful agents can be broken down into non-opioid medications, opioid medications, and adjuvant medications, or also considered medications that have no direct pain-relieving properties but are often used to help treat other symptoms that can have a positive impact on pain control. Non-opioid medications are generally preferred as first-line agents. There are a variety of non-opioid medications available, including several over-the-counter products such as aspirin, acetaminophen, local anesthetics like lidocaine patches, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs. Prescription options include antidepressants, specifically serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors and tricyclic antidepressants, as well as anticonvulsants, muscle relaxants, and prescription NSAIDs. Non-opioid medications vary in their mechanisms of action to modulate pain. However, most tend to dominantly affect the ascending or descending pain pathways. However, they may interact with multiple receptors, neurotransmitters, and other chemical substances, such as prostaglandins and substance P. Various formulations and administration routes exist across analgesic medications and can impact the onset of analgesia, the metabolism, drug interactions, and side effect profile. Oral tablets and capsules are most common and cost-effective, though most susceptible to first-pass metabolism. Buccal and sublingual administration offer alternatives for those with gastrointestinal complications. However, storage issues and cost can pose a barrier. Rectal administration offers rapid absorption and can be ideal for certain patients in order to limit exposure, though this may be limited depending on patient population. Topical analgesics can also be useful to limit systemic exposure. However, these may be limited to addressing localized pain versus diffuse or widespread systemic pain. Drug formulations may also be available in immediate release, delayed release, and extended release formulations, which can help provide greater duration of analgesia or allow for specific onset of efficacy that may coincide with anticipated increases in pain symptoms. With a variety of analgesic medications available, it's common to see many patients prescribed two or more medications to treat their pain symptoms. While no single combination is recommended by guidelines, it is recommended to use medications from different drug classes. The concept of multimodal medication use can be helpful in achieving greater pain relief, minimizing side effects, and improving other comorbid symptoms or disease states. Many combination products already exist to take advantage of this multimodal approach. Most products include an opioid medication as well as a non-opioid component, most commonly acetaminophen. One limitation to utilizing combination products is the reduced ability to customize the dose, as well as needing to consider individual limitations on doses based on the acetaminophen or NSAID components due to comorbidities, as well as renal and hepatic function. Now we will look at several non-opioid medications in more detail. So one of the most common medications utilized, acetaminophen's mechanism of action on pain is largely unconfirmed, though it is hypothesized to primarily work through activation of the serotonergic inhibitory pathway. Prostaglandin inhibition and anti-inflammatory properties are weak at best. Patients with heavy alcohol use or severe hepatic dysfunction are not ideal candidates for acetaminophen treatment, though it may be a preferred agent in patients with cardiovascular disease or higher risk of gastrointestinal bleeding. Various products are available both over-the-counter and in prescription products. Depending on the dose and formulation, it generally needs to be dosed 3 to 6 times per day. Self-administered maximum doses are recommended to be capped at 3 grams per day, though this may be increased up to 4 grams per day with provider or physician oversight. Patients with heavy alcohol use or evidence of possible liver dysfunction should be advised on utilizing lower daily doses with ongoing evaluation of labs and symptoms. Aspirin provides pain relief through irreversible inhibition of cyclooxygenase enzymes 1 and 2, as well as by blocking formation of prostaglandin derivatives. Unlike acetaminophen, it possesses anti-inflammatory properties. Several safety considerations exist, including caution in those with kidney and liver disease, those with a higher risk for bleeding, and patients who have an elevated risk of GI adverse effects, such as utilization of higher doses, history of or current ulcerative disease, concurrent use of NSAIDs or corticosteroids, older adults, and those who are current smokers. Like acetaminophen, several formulations and products exist for aspirin. Dosing for analgesia is higher than what is indicated for primary prevention of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease and generally needs to be dosed multiple times per day. In most cases, acetaminophen or NSAIDs are going to be preferred over high-dose aspirin for pain control. Which brings me into our next discussion on non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or NSAIDs. These medications work by inhibiting both cyclooxygenase 1 and 2 enzymes similar to aspirin, as well as inhibiting the formation of prostaglandin precursors. The extent to which a specific NSAID blocks either enzyme determines if we consider it to be a selective, semi-selective, or non-selective NSAID. Selective NSAIDs inhibit the cyclooxygenase 2 enzyme preferentially and confer a lower risk of adverse gastrointestinal events, including ulcerative bleeding. Currently, celecoxib is the only selective NSAID available. Despite the potential for lower risks for specific agents, all NSAIDs do carry a risk of increased gastrointestinal events, cardiovascular events, and concerns over renal toxicity. Risk varies based on the specific medication, dose, duration, other medications, as well as comorbidities of the individual patient. And while literature varies, celecoxib or use of a gastroprotective agent, such as an acid-lowering agent or sulforaphane, are recommended in patients with a higher risk for gastrointestinal adverse effects. Naproxen has some limited data suggesting greater safety in those with elevated cardiovascular risk, and similar studies suggest that ibuprofen or Sulindac may confer a lower risk of contributing to kidney impairment. Topical agents such as diclofenac may be helpful for musculoskeletal or joint pains in joints close to the surface. Diclofenac is an NSAID, so use of a topical formulation helps to limit systemic exposure. Lidocaine, on the other hand, is a sodium channel blocker on peripheral neurons, hence its potential benefit for peripheral neuropathic pain as well as postherpetic neuralgia, specifically in patients who are experiencing allodynia. While diclofenac needs to be applied multiple times per day, lidocaine patches can be applied up to 24 hours, and multiple patches may be used in a single 24-hour period. These specific instructions are dependent on the manufacturer, so it's always important that providers and patients read the labels clearly before applying any of these topical agents. Capsaicin is another topical agent that has demonstrated majority of benefit in neuropathic pain. It alleviates pain by activating transient receptor potential vanilloid 1 receptors on cutaneous nociceptors, which causes a breakdown of cytoskeletal components of neuronal fibers and results in a defunctionalized nociceptor. While effective, frequent dosing, localized erythema, and potential for cross-contamination on non-affected body areas may be barriers to long-term use. out of the antidepressant class, serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, as well as tricyclic antidepressants, have the most evidence in the treatment of chronic pain. SNRIs target pain by increasing levels of norepinephrine and serotonin, which appear to strengthen the system that inhibits pain transmission through the descending pathway. There is a large body of evidence that dual-action antidepressants are more effective versus serotonergic dominant antidepressants. Most studies demonstrate greater benefit in neuropathic and nociplastic pain syndromes, though there is some evidence that they may also alleviate chronic musculoskeletal pain. How well they work also has little to do with how effective they are as antidepressants specifically, though they may also indirectly improve pain symptoms by improving anxiety, depression, and sleep parameters. While acetaminophen, aspirin, and NSAIDs tend to work quickly, antidepressants can take 2 to 3 weeks to see significant improvement in pain symptoms. Duloxetine, desvenlafaxine, and venlafaxine have greater serotonin reuptake inhibition versus norepinephrine. Conversely, levonorgestrel and milnacipram have greater norepinephrine reuptake inhibition. Other key clinical considerations to be aware of include the ability to recognize duloxetine as a moderate inhibitor of cytochrome 2D6 and to exercise caution in patients with hepatic disease. It is also the only SNRI FDA approved for chronic musculoskeletal pain. Venlafaxine has minimal norepinephrine reuptake inhibition at doses less than 200 milligrams per day and carries a higher risk of discontinuation syndrome when stopping treatment abruptly. Levonorgestrel requires dose adjustments for patients with a creatinine clearance less than 60 milliliters per minute, and milnacipram carries specific titration instructions due to higher rates of nausea versus other SNRIs. While there is some evidence that antidepressants may work at lower doses than are required for depression treatment, this is not always true, and some people require higher doses for maximum pain relief. As a class, SNRIs are associated with transient side effects such as gastrointestinal upset and anxiety, which generally resolve in the first 1 to 2 weeks after initiating or making dose adjustments. SNRIs may also cause elevated blood pressure, dry mouth, and constipation, with the latter two most commonly occurring with duloxetine. Sexual dysfunction is a common long-term side effect of all antidepressants, and all patients should be educated on risk for discontinuation syndrome with missed doses or abrupt cessation, as well as education on monitoring for mood changes or suicidal ideation. While less common, serotonin syndrome, increased bleeding risk, acute angle closed glaucoma, decreased bone mineral density, and hyponatremia are serious events to consider, specifically in at-risk patients. All patients who are being tapered off of an SNRI or TCA should be educated on discontinuation syndrome. It is important to educate patients on discontinuation syndrome when initiating treatment as well, as they may experience this with missed doses, and this can often be mistaken for side effects or new symptoms. Symptoms of discontinuation syndrome usually include both physical and mental symptoms, such as dizziness, insomnia, or sensory disturbances, as well as anxiety, irritability, and mood changes. Now, in addition to SNRIs, TCAs can also be helpful for providing pain relief. In general, TCAs have fallen largely out of favor due to their side effect profile. However, there are some patients who still benefit from these medications, and their utility at lower doses may make them more tolerable. As a class, they have a similar mechanism of action to SNRIs, though they also impact adrenergic, histamine, and muscarinic receptors to varying degrees. Secondary amines are preferred over tertiary amines due to greater selectivity for the norepinephrine transporter and better side effect profile. TCAs also lack 2D6 inhibition that other SSRIs and SNRIs possess, but they do inhibit cytochrome P2C19. As a class, TCAs possess anticholinergic effects to varying degrees. They may also increase the risk for hypotension due to adrenergic blockade. Sexual dysfunction and weight gain are also seen with long-term use. Patients who are at greatest risk for adverse events with TCAs include older adults and those with pre-existing cardiovascular and neurological disorders. It is also important to consider the potential lethality of TCAs in the event of an overdose, and patients may experience discontinuation syndrome as well as anticholinergic withdrawal with abrupt discontinuation due to the side effect profile of this drug class. While therapeutic drug monitoring is utilized in the treatment of depression, there is limited data in pain response studies. However, serum concentrations of TCAs can assist with ongoing safety monitoring for select patients. Amitriptyline and imipramine are the parent drugs of nortriptyline and desipramine. Nortriptyline and desipramine possess the lowest anticholinergic effects and are generally preferred in older adults or those who are at higher risk of experiencing side effects. Protriptyline is included here to note that this is the TCA with the longest half-life. So for some select patients, this may be an optimal choice in terms of trying to provide longer-term pain control. Whenever antidepressant treatment is considered, monitoring for serotonin syndrome or serotonin toxicity is important. Although rare, it can occur. It is a toxidrome that is caused by increase in intrasynaptic as well as peripheral serotonin. The onset is usually within the first 24 to 48 hours following the introduction of a serotonergic agent, a dose increase, or a potential drug interaction. Symptoms generally occur in three different domains, which include mental status changes, neuromuscular hyperactivity, and autonomic instability. Gabapentin and pregabalin are collectively coined gabapentinoids. Both are widely utilized and recommended in the treatment of neuropathic pain. They work by reducing calcium ion influx at the dorsal horn through modulation of voltage-gated calcium channels. In addition to benefits on pain symptoms, gabapentinoids can also reduce anxiety symptoms and improve sleep. While some effects are immediate, 2 to 3 weeks is generally recommended to allow full efficacy. While gabapentin and pregabalin share the same mechanism of action and few pharmacokinetic characteristics, they do have some notable differences, particularly when it comes to absorption and bioavailability. Gabapentin is absorbed via the L-aminotransferase, which shows a saturable absorption process. This dramatically affects bioavailability as doses are increased. Gabapentin and Carbil, which is a prodrug of gabapentin, was designed to be transported by two high-capacity transporters, and therefore enables greater bioavailability when administered with food. When we look at the gabapentin absorption, we see that bioavailability begins to plateau once doses surpass 900 milligrams. Here, bioavailability reduces to roughly 60%. This saturable process impacts both total daily doses as well as individual doses. As a rule of thumb with gabapentinoid dosing, start low and increase slow. Dose adjustments can typically be made every 5 to 7 days, and patients with renal impairment will require dose adjustments, with the threshold for dose adjustments starting at 79 or 59 milliliters per minute, depending on the specific gabapentin formulation. The pain response also varies individually and can be seen across dosing range, with higher doses tending to result in more side effects. Similar to gabapentin, starting doses should be on the lower side, with further dose titration once tolerance has been established when initiating a pregabalin formulation. It also requires renal adjustment for patients with renal impairment. So patients with a creatinine clearance of less than 60 milliliters per minute will require dose reductions. And for the extended release formulation, those with a creatinine clearance less than 30, use is not recommended. In general, gabapentinoids are well tolerated and common side effects of dizziness and somnolence tend to resolve with continued use. Patients who concurrently take other CNS depressants, specifically benzodiazepines and opioids, may be at increased risk of respiratory depression. Caution should be used in those with existing lung conditions when other CNS depressants are also involved. While suicidal ideation and behavior are included as warnings, this has been largely extrapolated from data in patients with seizure disorders who are at an elevated baseline risk. Similarly, mood changes and suicidal ideation are key monitoring parameters in the holistic care of patients with chronic pain. While data regarding gabapentin misuse and withdrawal symptoms are forthcoming, it is best practice to taper when discontinuing, and it is recommended to taper over a 1 to 2 week period. The overall risk for misuse in the general population is considered low, and current estimates suggest less than 2% of patients. However, those with concurrent substance use disorders or concurrent use of benzodiazepines and opioids have an increased risk. Depending on the particular state of practice, prescription drug monitoring programs may track both gabapentin and pregabalin prescriptions, and this can assist in identifying patterns of misuse. Oxcarbazepine is an anti-epileptic drug, which may help pain symptoms by blocking voltage-gated sensitive sodium channels and stabilizing hyperexcitable neuronal membranes. Compared to carbamazepine, which is also commonly used in the treatment of trigeminal neuralgia, oxcarbazepine has less drug interactions and lacks CYP3A4 induction as well as auto-induction properties, which makes carbamazepine challenging to use. Most trials for oxcarbazepine are positive, and clinically we see responses in patients with no or minimal response to gabapentinoids or SNRIs. Unlike gabapentinoids, oxcarbazepine is hepatically metabolized and highly protein-bound, so consideration of hepatic function is important. Common side effects include dizziness, drowsiness, and gastrointestinal disturbances, which are all generally dose-dependent and may resolve with continued use. Serious warnings and precautions include blood dyscrasias, risk of hyponatremia, and hypersensitivity reactions, of which genetic testing is recommended for patients of Asian descent for the variant HLA allele B1502 before therapy initiation. Muscle relaxants are the last drug class that we will be discussing today. Their mechanism of action varies based on the specific agent. However, they generally provide their effects by depressing the central nervous system and/or directly modulating motor neurons. They are effective for muscle spasms with no clear superiority of one particular agent over another. Choosing an agent is therefore typically based on side effect profile, presence of spasticity, and other comorbidities. Class side effects include sedation, weakness, and central nervous system depression. Of note, cursiprodol is a Schedule 4 medication and has higher rates of sedation. Cyclobenzaprine is similar in structure to TCAs and may benefit neuropathic as well as nociplastic pain. There are high variances in dosing, hepatic metabolism, and whether they act centrally or peripherally. Some agents, including baclofen, dantrolene, and tizanidine, also possess antispastic properties and so may benefit particular patients with comorbidities in which that property is desired. When determining which drug class or classes of medications to employ in a treatment plan, it is important to ensure that the medication has demonstrated benefit for the specific pain syndrome. If there are multiple pain types present, then capitalizing on a multimodal approach or medications that may benefit multiple pain types due to dual mechanism of action may be a good starting point. It is also imperative to consider other disease states that a particular medication may benefit or potentially negatively impact by that medication choice. It is also important to consider historical medication trials for each specific patient, as well as individual risk factors that may increase both short-term as well as long-term side effects. Thank you.